Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's February 7th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator for funded startups that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by using our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. No matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help your startup launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery every time. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with underperforming infrastructure, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll chart a roadmap for success free. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like. Ask questions. If you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us live by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's Office Hours valuable, please share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse or send a short testimonial about the value you're getting in our Slack team. Just go to slack.cloudposse.com. Remember, we are not just simply creating content here. We are building a community, and we can't do that without your help. So with that said, let's jump into this week's announcements. First one, something we are very excited about is the Terraform resource for the AWS landing zones just merged. I think that happened yesterday or 2 days ago. That's going to be incorporated in the 5.36 release of the Terraform AWS provider. That means you'll finally be able to manage at least a small portion of Control Tower using Terraform. No one's probably tried using that yet. It's only been 2 days, and you would have had to build your own provider. All right. Next announcement.
I was just going to add that I've read through the code and looked at a bunch of the examples and everything, and it's definitely a step in the right direction, but it's almost like a resource that would just like let you provide like a cloud formation template to it. It's like very, like the inputs are not really, don't feel really natively Terraform. It feels like you're passing some other format to this one resource that then does a bunch of magic behind the scenes. It's not like a bunch of resources and sub resources and things that you would expect. I don't know. It doesn't feel native Terraform to me, I guess, yeah, is what I'll say, in playing around with it.
I mean, yeah. Okay. So the one thing, it doesn't feel native Terraform. Is it also probably more likely that the underlying API exposed by AWS is very rudimentary?
Could be. Yeah. The API call is literally just taking the document that it packages up and ships it to the endpoint and says like implement this. So it's hard to really tell what's happening under the scene, behind the scenes. But I don't know. It just doesn't feel like you'll have the fine grained control over everything like you do in a lot of other instances. But this is only version one of their control tower support. So hopefully over time, it will be better.
AWS conspiracy theory. All they've done was implement a account factory dynamically on the back end for you. And then this is just committing that to the code commit or something. Again, just unqualified conspiracy theory. Yeah. All right. Next announcement was we brought this topic up recently. I think it was 2 weeks ago or so, based on chatter and a GitHub issue related to the controller for Terraform managed by Weaveworks related to the Flux project. There was mentions there that don't expect any updates. Well, it has been confirmed now that Weaveworks is shutting down. They had raised well over 60 million, but unfortunately it wasn't enough to pull off what they tried to do. It's really sad, I think, to see one of the earliest companies in this whole cloud native movement fail, especially one that, you know, has its roots in open source. And I mean, Flux, I mean, Weaveworks, they invented the term GitOps, basically. They certainly pioneered what it meant for Kubernetes through Flux. Flux is going to live on through the CNCF. It's already a project there. And they've committed to, you know, ensuring that enough resources are there that the project lives on. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what that means for Flux and, you know, what direction Flux will go without, obviously, this significant corporate sponsor of Weaveworks behind it. Does that mean, you know, and also looking back, I wonder, you know, there was a time when Flux and Argo CD almost merged, but then that fell through. And I'm just wondering if those were some of the early indicators of this failure.
It always amazes me, having been part of many startups that were not like, you know, these kind of like giant either home runs or absolute misses. Like, they're like moderately successful, like middle of the road kind of startups. And it always amazes me that you can spend the kind of money that they've spent, like 60 plus million dollars, and not solve the problem that they're trying to solve and not figure out how to monetize it and you know, all those things. I mean, it's just clearly like people who are just, you know, it's, you know, whatever, OPM, right? It's other people's money, so it's easy to spend. And that's kind of the risk of doing these things. And if you hit it big, you know, everyone's happy. But when you take 60, like, think about that, $60 million and flush it down the drain. It's crazy to me, like, that for what they're trying to solve. Like, they should have either figured it out in the first couple of years or, you know, and cut bait then, or, you know, or moved, you know, or been successful. Like, that's kind of what I feel like. I don't know. It's just a weird commentary on the whole thing.
No, I agree. I was trying to, I don't know, I guess it was not, I'm not finding it as fast as I was hoping to. There was interesting commentary on Hacker News about it. The bulk of the comments of the first one here, the bulk of the comments seem to be that, you know, as soon as they took that money, the expectation is, you know, to take radical risks, and you have to turn it into something that's going to do a 10x return. And that's what I guess they were doing, the moonshot. But
yeah,
it's an unfortunate consequence of taking venture capital. You can no longer just build a great sustainable business. It has to be a moonshot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also is a function of how much venture capital you raise. Like, if you raise a couple million bucks so you can, like, actually get an idea to market and, you know, do all those kind of things, and you start generating revenue and you need a little bit more to you know, grow a little bit bigger. Yeah. But when you take these giant tranches of VC capital and they're on your board, and now they own, you know, 50, 40, 50% of the company, and, you know, whatever, you know, it becomes like everyone is burying their head in the sand, and it's not like, it's not really about making a product and being successful anymore. It's about getting to the next raise, or to the acquisition, or to the IPO, or to whatever. And like, the actual mission of the company goes astray really quickly when you start launching these things. And I mean, clearly some have been successful, but far fewer have been, you know, in doing these giant, you know, capital raises and doing that. And as crazy it is, $60 million isn't even giant in, you know, compared to what's going on. So anyway, I'm just kind of like blabbering about this, but it was just my reaction when I read it.
Well, and as you said it, you remind me of one thing, which was that apparently there was possibly an acquisition that was going to happen, but that fell through. I'm curious who the suitor was, if anybody would guess.
Yeah, my guess would have been Microsoft, but who knows?
That's interesting. Yeah.
Based on what I read, but I'm not sure if that's true.
Jonathan, I see you raised your hand.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, isn't this also the problem that we're seeing with Terraform and Vault and, you know, basically the company that is at the center of a lot of this DevOps infrastructure as code that we all use and love and has found even kind of at its level of success that it's not pulling in enough money and has to make really draconian changes to the business model that put itself at risk. I think we've seen a lot of these type of almost either burning out, flaming out, at risk of flaming out. It's quite frightening as someone who, you know, invests in these tools and has to deploy stuff and plan for the future of deploying stuff that so many of them are being acquired or seem at risk of flaming out.
Yeah, and when you look at the HashiCorp of the world, then the numbers start to become like crazy, because I think they've raised around $350 million. And as a venture, you know, person who invested in that, or, you know, collection of them, they're someone looking for a 10x return means that they somehow need to generate an exit of $3.5 billion to, you know, to essentially get their, you know, their return. So it's, I don't know. I think these numbers start to get crazy, and you know, at some point, it's like they can only do things that don't make sense to, you know, to keeping the mission of the company and the spirit of the product. Or it's rare that they can keep those things intact while also satisfying all the people who put in these crazy amounts of money and looking for, you know, looking for returns out there.
Yeah. And it's, I wonder, you know, at some point this is going to have ramifications for future open source based companies and tooling. I'm not sure if the reverberations have hit yet, but there's a tipping point, and I don't want to be caught up in that.
There's a couple of interesting comments in the comments here. So Vlad said, WeaveWorks didn't have a business model, but HashiCorp has a business. They're just bad at it. It's a pretty fair point on that one. And then Michael Percival here says that I reject the HashiCorp public position that open source is dead and cannot be monetized. They failed to monetize it because they are actively rejecting their client requests. I send them buckets of money. They refuse to spend it and refuse to do what I'm asking of them. They promote their Terraform cloud, which we won't use. So, I mean, that's a more detailed version of Vlad's TLDR, like HashiCorp is bad at their business, you know, kind of. But yes, I get it.
But wasn't actually WeaveWorks business almost identical to HashiCorp in the sense that they commercialized Flux and made a hosted solution with dashboards, which is identical to what HashiCorp did with Terraform and made a dashboard essentially and a CD product around it?
Sort of. they did.
I guess didn't add up.
Yeah. Well, it looks like Vlad wants to say something. He has his hand.
Yeah, Vlad.
Yeah, one more thing to note is that we are all discussing what's public here. There is a lot of drama and gossip and a lot of stuff that is happening or that is not being discussed in public about this, and that is more or well known. Just wanted to put that out there. About HashiCorp, about WeaveWorks, like tech is very much Gossip Girl. And what we are seeing in press releases and LinkedIn posts is very often only a tiny, tiny part of the story.
That probably goes without saying. I'm curious, any watering holes one can learn more about those things?
No idea.
Awkward silence there. Okay. Well, that's actually an interesting segue into another topic. I'm going to go out of order here. which is jumping over to Once by DHH. So they have launched a new brand or a new company with a interesting kind of premise. It used to be back in the day you bought software and you could run that software pretty much as long as it was there and it didn't need like a critical patch or update. It would just work. And we've since been conditioned to use SaaS, and there's a lot of value in SaaS, don't get me wrong, but at some point we are literally SaaSed to death. And we are spending so much money on SaaS, we have no control on when they pull features, remove features, raise their prices, and that's a liability for a business. So they've started this company with this idea of let's go back to brass tacks and sell software that isn't based on a subscription, that is affordable for the masses. And in that, they have released this Campfire product as one of their first products. $299 fee, one time for that major release, right? So the next major release, you would have to pay some sort of an upgrade fee, presumably. It doesn't go into that. But unlimited seats, you host it however you want to host it. They talk about down here below some of the hosting requirements. Like if you have 10,000 concurrent users, mind you, you're spending $299 for those 10,000 concurrent users. So that's not too bad. But yeah, you would want to have a machine with a little bit of more horsepower, but this is pretty insignificant these days for that many simultaneous users. Is it a true Slack replacement? I'm sure it's missing a huge number of features that Slack has, third-party integrations, App Store. I mean, these days, Slack, we don't just use Slack as Slack. We use Slack together with this ecosystem of integrations. I'm sure that might be coming sometime in the future for this product, but not now. And then like Slack Connect and other things. So anyways, if you just need a simple alternative or you need a place, they give some use cases here, like you need an internal chat that's maybe for executives, or you need a backup for when Slack crashes and that has happened regularly, then this could be a thing. Curious some people's thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think what has been a consistent theme to me, with at least over the last couple of years with every DHH post, is that he completely sets aside and or discounts the operational costs of doing these things, and like to run like servers. So like people have mission critical things that revolve around Slack. They have integrations, they have, like you were talking about, they have chat ops that you can approve things, you can have all of these other things, right? Like just that are tied into your ecosystem, which means that they become mission critical systems. And like the cost of high availability, backups, scaling, data protection, security, patch management, monitoring, dot dot dot, for all of these things is certainly not $299 once. And when you start looking at what it means as you're building, like the reason that SaaS has always been so attractive to everyone is that the pitch is that you can offload all of those things to other people because they aren't your core competencies. Like figuring out, like your business doesn't make money by like running servers to make sure that your chat product runs. Your business makes money by selling your product or selling your own SaaS solution that you sell to your customers, or whatever it is out there. And like just completely ignoring total cost of ownership of these things and comparing the SaaS price to the one-time price is disingenuous. And he's not a dumb man, so he clearly knows this and he's doing it intentionally, right? So I think that's really irksome to me, like in every one of these posts that he's written
That's a
recently.
fair point. Vlad, you raised your hand.
He's not ignoring it, he's just stupid. Somebody put it very nice on Twitter. Bitcoin did a speed run of the last 30 years of finance and banking in like 5 years. And they were like, oh, that's why we do that in finance. That's why we have transfers that take that long, or that's why we have all these controls. DHS is speed running the last 15 years of how to build and deliver technical products. And the problem is that he's ignoring everything that we've learned, but he has a platform and he's spewing bullshit. Short example would be the idiotic way that they do versioning. Like, yeah, this is just, we tried to sell tech products like this. Like, you pay for it once, you own it, good luck. Well, the problem with that is it's a one-time thing, so it's not sustainable. That means you are then incentivized to only give Campfire V1 bug fixes. That's it. Any major feature is going to go into Campfire 2, which is going to be released 2 years from now, because you cannot release Campfire 1 now and Campfire 2, that's going to be $2.99 yet again in like 6 months. So you're going to keep all the new features that you want to release. You're going to basically gatekeep them and not release them for a year until Campfire 2 comes out. And that is bullshit. And we don't want to do that. And that's not good for the users. And we've learned that that pricing model and that business strategy doesn't typically work for product like this and all that stuff. Like, these are tech business lessons that we have learned and that we know. He is willfully ignoring them and spewing bullshit. And it's dumb and stupid.
All right. Well, there you have it. Venkat, you had something to add to this?
Yeah, one question, one comment. I'll go with the comment first. This whole pricing model reminds me of WordPress plugins, where you pay up front and you kind of own it.
Right.
And to Vlad and Matt's point, like, doesn't usually work out in the long run if you have a serious company or serious business or anything beyond for fun, I guess. And then the other, I guess, a question: what are folks here using as a fallback to their primary chat system? So whether you use Slack or whatever it might be, or Teams, or any teams here, especially given all of us are in the SRE DevOps like infra space. When stuff goes down, obviously you want to be able to communicate with your team. Looks like.
AWS Chime all the way. No, I'm joking.
I'm actually using Campfire. I love it. I'm just kidding.
I was thinking, honestly, for $300, it might not be a bad idea to use as a backup. I'll just see if it integrates well with the SSO and all of that. But curious to know if anyone's got.
I mean, Google Chat, right? That's never, that's always surprises me in the end. I forget that we have it, but when we've had outages in Slack, suddenly I start getting all these Google Chat messages. So.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things is that the good thing about Slack is that it's out of band from all the crap that you're running. Like if something you break, if you break your infrastructure, you're not going to
Yeah.
affect your chat platform because it's still up and running. You can still communicate with everyone, right? I mean, I guess technically, like PagerDuty and some of those other things also have incident management that has real time, chat abilities as well. So that might be another good choice as a backup in case Slack were down.
Oh, I didn't realize that PagerDuty. Sorry, did you say PagerDuty or which? I don't
Yeah.
remember
When you in,
out in there.
basically, when you declare an incident, like there's a real time like chat around the incident, and everyone can chime in on what's going on and talk about it and paste logs and
So
all that kind of
you
stuff.
just create an incident for when Slack is down, and then you transfer
Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty good option, actually. We're using Opsgenie off to see if they have that or if we should just migrate. Thanks, guys.
to.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. And yeah, Vlad
Vlad.
says that there is this thing called a phone. You can also use those and text message.
I don't know how it is on your teams, but I feel like a phone, like now you need to have that directory for it. Or if you already have it synced from your company directory, that's great. We're a pretty small team, so we don't have that set up, unfortunately.
I
And
do recommend, like, I this has bit me before. That I realize because that's how we work these days. Like, we never meet each other in person. The job interview wasn't over the phone, it was over Zoom. And, 2 years can pass and you've never had to call the person. Until that time, you have to call the person and you don't have their number. So we've made a point of getting everyone's 411 into our system so we can access them when that.
Good idea. We have a basic Google Doc. You should probably check on that and see if it's up to date.
Yeah, and if you have a small team, just ask everyone, hey, what's your number? Stick it in your phone. And then you could start a group chat with everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be that complicated.
That's true.
Okay. So yeah, that was that announcement. Jumping back up here to a utility called Chalk that I saw. This is not something we've had to solve or address, but I thought it was interesting because I hadn't seen any other tool yet in this category come across my radar. So this is a way of, it seems like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like watermarking almost your artifacts with information about or metadata with perhaps where that artifact originated or was created. And then you can extract or read that metadata out. I'm not sure how it does this in a generic way. And I don't see kind of what types of artifacts it supports. I just know it says any artifact, and that seems like a bold claim. So I don't understand it.
It might just write some sort of binary thing in it, in the metadata. I don't know.
Right, but okay, so my artifact is a markdown file. Is it, what's it gonna do? It's gonna, mark up the markup, or I understand Docker images that have annotations. I understand images which have metadata like JPEGs and PNGs, etc. I'm not sure about tarballs or some of the other archive formats. They might have that ability.
Especially if you're using any kind of like checksumming, it could have a problem too. I don't know how they get around that.
Yeah. So just curious to learn more. Somebody was asking, is this related to SBOMs? And yeah, this is in some way related to that, to make it easier to pull down a graph of all the relationships.
I got confused when I first saw it because Chalk is a library for like writing to the console in
JavaScript. Bracelet, or was that one of theirs, or
I don't know if they're the ones who make it, but it's definitely they might be. I just don't remember. I just know that it's been around for a while.
All right, Venkat, you rate, and Jonathan. Well, Venkat, you first, I guess, then Jonathan.
Sorry, I think that was from last time.
Okay, Jonathan.
I just wondered, since we're talking SBOMs again, I wanted to get a quick sense. We are getting customers starting to ask us to disclose our complete vulnerability chains, complete build chains. We have not done so. We have pushed off on that, but I'm wondering whether we have folks on the in the community that are like really getting requirements that the full SBOM be provided or similar kind of metadata reports, auditable reports, that sort of thing. Is this a new thing that's really getting serious?
I think there was a conversation related or surrounded to this in the compliance channel on SweetOps, but I know you're a member of that channel, so not adding much. We don't hear it coming from our customers yet. If that adds anything.
Yeah, I know there's a new federal, request or best practice, but we've only been asked a couple of times and we've explicitly said, no, thank you. We're not going to do that. And we've gotten away with it so far.
Yeah.
Good.
In case anyone's looking for a solution, a couple of years ago when I spoke to the Artifactory team, they seemed to have a really good SBOM solution where you could just basically use them as a proxy for all of your tool chain, and then they'll automatically create a SBOM for you. I'm not sure if it gives you the level of granularity that you'll need to be compliant for these new things, but it looked like it was pretty cool. If you want to see what licenses are being used across your stack or what those dependencies are, I don't know of any limits at that time that they weren't covering that particular package dependency management tool.
Yeah, Artifactory, boy, they're perfectly positioned for this. I wonder if they have lobbyists or something that
The where SBOMs really get good use is like if you're required to report out how many CVEs you have and what the severity of them are, like, you know, you're getting a accreditation of some kind to run in a government system, and they say, hey, if you have any high CVEs, you can't get in the system. You know, I've seen people spend days upon days just like manually building a Excel spreadsheet with, you know, these are all the libraries we use, the dependencies, the containers, the tools, here's the versions of them all. Now I have to go, you know, manually search the government NIST NVD database to go find all the CVEs and see if I'm vulnerable to any of them. With something like, you know, an S build an SBOM and then scan it is 10 seconds. You know, you run SIFT on your project, it builds you an SBOM, you run GRIPE on the SIFT SBOM, and it gives you that entire report. And then you can put it into your CI pipeline and say, hey, GRIPE, if you find any highs in my project, make the pipeline red. And GRIPE is really good at doing stuff like that. That's the power of SBOMs.
Yeah, it looks nice. Yeah, you must be dealing with this at Defense Unicorns, right, Andrew?
Every day. Every day. All of our stuff builds. You know, if we're building an application of any kind, or, you know, putting a Docker image through like a security pipeline, it's absolutely running SIFT and GRIPE. Because we have to provide that stuff in our ATO documentation as required.
Yeah, if anyone's interested, Andrew works at this company, Defense Unicorns. They have an interesting product, probably lots of experience.
Just curious on that environment, Andrew, if you have like this random Python package that you want to use, does that just set off a lot of alarms? Like if you want to, like if I wrote a Python package and published it in a GitHub repo and then you wanted to use it, does that usually just trigger a bunch of alarms given it's new, or I don't have like certain, like is there more of a processor environment, I guess, is the question, to be able to use random, or if you want to call it random, open source?
Probably not. The government is, I will, you know, com the government is definitely a lot of kind of security theater. You know, if you write some random, you know, library that nobody's ever heard of and you add it to your application, it's obviously not going to have any CVEs, which means it won't show up on the report, which means, you know, you might be green, your report might be green even if you aren't actually green. In reality. So it's so important to, you know, do defense in depth, have actual runtime security using like NeuVector or whatever. You know, we the DoD several years ago wrote a they call it the DoD Enterprise DevSecOps Reference Design, and it defines a platform that you run on top of Kubernetes. It's Istio, it's Devs DoD Enterprise DevSecOps Reference Design. It defines a platform on top of Kubernetes that's like, you know, you have to have a service mesh with Istio, you have to have or you don't have to use Istio, but you have to have a service mesh, you have to have, you know, runtime security, you have to you know, do like SSO, you have to do MFA, you know, and it lays all that out. So there's a government software factory called Platform One. They build our product called Big Bang. My company took Big Bang and made it better, basically, so that you can, you know, just run all that on top of, I mean, I don't want to turn this into a advertisement for my company or anything, but That's it's really just one layer of the stack is doing like that kind of security scan. 'Cause you're gonna be adding in like that's not the only thing they're gonna make you do. You know, they're gonna make you do like code quality scan, SAST with SonarQube or whatever. SonarQube's gonna, you know, do a deep inspect of all your packages and stuff and look for things it knows about. You know, there's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
I think that I was just gonna add really quickly that static analysis tools are actually really good at like looking at your Python library that isn't known anywhere and identifying things that it may be doing that are suspicious and flagging them like sneak as a or snick or however you pronounce SNYK. I can never I don't know how to do it, but like they have a pretty good static analysis tooling that will identify anything that might be a potential vulnerability in, you know, in a bunch of different languages.
Uh,
Add
Andrew
to the
Gotchkin, I saw you had your hand up earlier. Was there a question from you related to this or something else? Or,
Oh, me?
yeah, sorry, I said your wrong name, the wrong last name there.
No, I was just going to ask Andy if he had any links to papers about using SIFT, SBOM, and GRIPE, but I Googled it myself and I think I found some stuff. Also, I can look on your Defense Unicorn site. Thank you.
I wanted to jump in and I don't remember who asked the initial question. Matt, Andy, don't remember. But there are requirements starting to come up for folks doing more sensitive data about what dependencies you're using and how mature they are. And I don't know exactly if they made it into law yet, but a bunch of companies that are working with more sensitive data think public utilities like energy providers, water providers, stuff like that, they got the nudge to, hey, you need to really clean up your dependency chain. No random dependencies that are one-man shops that were posted on GitHub like 5 years ago, and that's it, and things like that. It's still very, very new, but I've seen requests and companies start to clean that up. But for most people, that's at least 5 years out, I would say.
All right. Well, thank you for all that input. I guess we'll move on to one of the next announcements. Was that DEF CON was canceled, but has come back now. It's interesting. I mean, ever since I was in high school, it has been at Caesar's Palace in Vegas, and now it is n there no longer. But I think based on this, it sounds like a pretty great opportunity. They have found a new home at the Las Vegas Convention Center, which is much larger. And I guess new fronts for all the kind of jokes, jokery that goes on, including the largest LCD. I'm gonna, how long it's gonna take for that to get hacked? Cloudflare, this is old news by now. I'm sure everyone has seen this in their LinkedIn feed, et cetera. They came out with an additional write-up on kind of what they saw happened. And Apple introduces a new programming language called PKL or Pickle. Not sure how you pronounce it.
Yeah, it's pickle.
Yeah, kind of makes me think of Q a little bit in its purpose. It, you know, looks pretty clean like this as written. HCL started out this way as well, and it was pretty clean. And then, you know, after many, many iterations, it just devolves into what it is today. Matt can feel that. He was just working on some really ugly map construction in HCL. Anyways, I don't know how I feel about it. You know, I can understand the desire to keep moving things forward, and this is looks interesting, but I don't know, nothing that I think we're going to jump on right now.
I think if you scroll up, I think it's at the top of this thing where they talk about it. Those two paragraphs, the second and the third, the one that you have highlighted and the one after it, are actually very reminiscent of the conversation we just had about trying to express very complex infrastructures in YAML and why they created this based on the things that I was saying. And then they start to say, now you have a need to make it dry, so you add special properties. Mm-hmm. You start to add like loops and create a special DSL for it. And it's like, you know, all these things. And at the end of the day, that's not the best thing, so they created this. You know, it's kind of funny that the timing of the release of this.
Yeah, that is interesting. And ultimately, this can reduce to or compile to basically JSON or YAML or something, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it does. It basically takes all of that as an intermediate language and compiles to almost any kind of configuration language that you could think of.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
It's, if you read it, it's interesting because they do talk about kind of a lot of the journey that we've gone through in Atmos about building invalidations and imports and inheritance and like all that kind of stuff. It's like the journey is described very well of a lot of the things we've done in Atmos. So
yeah. All right. Let's see, we talked about that one. This one was just interesting to me personally. I didn't realize that Apple has a special edition of the iPhone that is jailbroken specifically for researchers, so they can pen test inside of the walled garden of the iPhone. So let's see what else. Yeah, this one here.
Sorry. I was just gonna say, interestingly, my friend is a security researcher and he lives down the street, and he has one of those, and he told me that the licensing agreement is crazy. Like, basically Apple owns it, and at any time they can ask you to return it, and there's like crazy fines and things if you don't. It's not something that you get, like it's something that they lend you to do like research basically as part of this whole thing. And it, like, you know how you can have your name like personalized or etched, or used to be able to, at least on like iPods and iPhones and stuff like that. Like on the back, it's engraved and it says like, you know, property of Apple and all that kind of stuff still on the back of it. So
I thought you were going to say it has the name of the researcher on there. So if he loses it, it's very clear who.
Yeah. Vlad's asking me. No, he doesn't have one at home. He just lives down the street from me and told me that he has one. He doesn't. I know. I think Vlad's also right. There's some sort of like crazy, like security controls around, like where you're allowed to use it and everything like that. So yeah,
I am very out of the loop on the iPhone security device, but I know that if you ever get access to any Apple hardware or previous stuff, it's very, very, very well defined, and you need to keep it in a room. The room needs to have no window. They need to, like, there is a very, very intense procedure for that. And yeah. I was curious, that was, like, if he had one at home, I was like, huh, they really open stuff?
No. I talked to him a lot because he lives down the street from me. I wasn't suggesting that the Apple, like, device is down the street from me. I have not actually played with it, but my point was, he was telling me about all the crazy like requirements around it, and I think like what you were saying, Glenn, I think it has some like physical like requirements around where you're allowed to keep it and everything as well. And they can ask for it back anytime, and you have a certain period of time to comply with that to get it back to them.
Almost at the end of announcements here, this was not the one I meant to click on, this one here. So last year, NitroCode, aka RB, posted that, asking if more maintainers could be added to the project. It looks like that didn't really go anywhere, and there were some recent commits back in December. I only bring it up because I was really impressed by this project over the last year or two. You know, they invested a lot. They moved it into its own organization, gave it a robust documentation portal. It has a pluggable interface now, so you can write Terraform doc plugins. So they invested a lot into the project. I was just wondering what happened, because it definitely has slowed down in terms of merging pull requests. And we have a pretty simple bug fix that we opened up that causes Terraform docs to crash if output values are null. And yeah, we haven't been able to get a hold of anyone. We've tried through GitHub, we've tried through LinkedIn, we've tried through other means, but we were really hoping to get this PR merged. And still, if anybody knows somebody who is a committer on Terraform docs, please pass them our way or share the PR. I'll post that in the Zoom chat.
Oh, it says someone approved the changes last week.
I think anyone can approve. I think anyone can approve. But, you know.
They're not merged.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm just suspecting that's what happened here. Let's see.
Yeah. The workflow requires approval from a maintainer, so you have to be like a core maintainer to approve the workflow. But...
yeah. So I thought this was an interesting little pet project. It caught my attention. I forget where I saw it. But it's a interactive chat with your Terraform state. So, you know, if you don't have better things to do on a Saturday night, you can always talk to your Terraform state file. And, I thought at first, I don't know how useful that would be, but then I saw like this question, how does the, AKS load, the federation secret from EKS? And then it was able to extract that from the Terraform state and express it quite intelligently. So
yeah.
I don't know how
it works. Now ask it, what is that secret?
Yeah, exactly. Since that secret is in there, and I bet it could be coaxed into telling you.
Yeah, and now the model knows about your secrets.
Yeah. Yeah, all your passwords belong to GPT. As Michael said. Hey, Jonathan, you raise your hand.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I've been using some generative AI to attempt to answer GRC questions that come our way. And we're using a commercial tool, Vanta. We have lots of source material, not really enough yet, I guess. But we're finding very often these tools answer enthusiastically and completely wrongly. If you ask a question that has any plausible answer, they really try hard to answer, and they're very enthusiastic and often just absolutely counterfactual.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true. Especially the more complicated the data. What were you going to say, Matt?
I was going to just say I have some, like, commentary on that is at one point in my career I was in like a fairly authoritative position over like a group of engineers, and I got some feedback from a colleague because I actually found that I was doing that personally, where I was saying something that I meant it to be expressed as like an opinion or an option or something for debate, but because of my seniority and the way I was expressing it, that it came across as if I were expressing it as fact. And it's actually really dangerous in group speaks when you have trust to do that. So now that we have computers doing that, it's even more dangerous. So yeah. Like I made a really conscious effort to start to point out things that were my opinion or were a premise that I had or something like that, rather than like authoritative. And now that we have these models that are doing, just what you said, it really bugs me that like I see that a lot. Like Like I asked ChatGPT yesterday some question about like something in Terraform, and it gave me this whole like if then else syntax to do something. And I was like, Terraform doesn't have if then else. And it was like, oh, you are correct. But the way it said it, it was like, this is absolutely the way to solve this problem. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? But because I had the knowledge to push back and challenge it, like I could do that. But if you're less experienced or, you know, don't have as much subject matter expertise, and you take these AI models' answers as, you know, as fact, it can be really dangerous. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how we solve that going forward, but you know, it needs a confidence score with its answer or something like that.
I think that was really funny, or some show of humility. Like, yeah, very common amongst engineers, myself included, very confident about our answers, even though we're totally wrong. So not far off from what GPT is doing.
So maybe it is really mimicking humans.
Yeah, it is. It's just exactly, where did it learn it from?
I was just going to piggyback on what Matt was saying. I was using ChatGPT to generate Terraform, and it was injecting JavaScript functions into the Terraform. And I mean, I could see right away, like, that's not valid Terraform. But an inexperienced person or somebody who's trying to learn Terraform with the tool, they're going to, you know, go ahead and take that as fact and run it. They're going to get a funky error, and they're going to spend another 2 or 3 days trying to fix it. Maybe they go back to ChatGPT and they do another session saying, tell me why this code is wrong, you know, but it just kind of slows them down that way. But my whole, and I know this isn't necessarily the point of the conversation here, but for people who worry about ChatGPT or AI taking their jobs, I say forget about it, because number one, you still got to train the model. And then number two, like you were saying, the confidence or validation, you got to look at what it gives you and know whether it's correct or not. And then number three, definitely how to apply it or whatever. So I think there's always going to be jobs for practitioners and technologists that know the technology and use AI as a tool to implement it.
Vlad just shared this project out of Amazon called Ref Checker that detects hallucinations. It sounds too good to be true. Like the things that were supposed to detect if something was written using AI, right?
No, this is more like, okay, we're going to connect LLMs with classic knowledge graph or something like that to validate what it's saying. They had a bunch of papers published on this, not only Amazon Science, but a bunch of other people too. LLMs are basically getting integrated. And it's now a question of trade-off. Like, is it still worth it, or are we better yet investing more in the knowledge graphs and things like that?
Mm-hmm. I wish they would automatically run this on X posts, tweets, whatever we call them these days. That would be great. Like half of what people write on X is a hallucination, you know, in one way or the other. So not generative hallucinations, but actual people writing things that are not factually correct. So
yeah, just that would detect be hallucinations in general.
Yeah.
That's funny. And let's see. Last one that I got, and we're out of time for today, basically, is Tap by Seal.io. It's a way to patch your Terraform resources. So basically, they have a Tap, they have their own markup in using HCL. And you say what you want it to do, add these resources to this thing, remove this from this thing, etc. And you can run it. I guess it's not dissimilar from, I think, I forget, there's one or two people in Japan that have been writing some really cool little utilities for like migrating resources or manipulating Terraform files, but I just don't remember the person right now.
You can do most of this with move blocks these days now.
I think this is